Andy Shovel is co-founder of this company making plant-based food mainstream through innovative meat alternatives. This isn't chicken, isn't beef burger, isn't sausage, etc. Have been making plant-based food skeptics think again. Now Andy has moved on from challenging traditional ideas around food and sustainability and is embarking on a new venture, A Bit Weird, where he's pushing boundaries by inviting us to laugh at the weird and horrible things we do to animals for food. In this interview, we'll dive into Andy's journey as an entrepreneur and the inspiration behind A Bit Weird. I'm Alex Crisp, and welcome to another episode of Future Foods Interviews, which you can catch all episodes on Substack and all podcast providers. Okay, so thank you, Andy Shovel, for coming on the program on Future Foods Interviews. And you are the CEO of this, or you have given up being the CEO of this? Is that correct? If you can just sort of give a little background of this and you and what kind of took you on this journey.
Sure. So I'm a has-been CEO. I'm not no longer CEO. We've got a new awesome guy called Mark in charge. And I guess I've co-founded this with my friend Pete. We launched 5.5 years ago or so. And we really felt that the UK market for meat alternatives was in a bit of a dour, unexciting place. And, you know, both from a product quality perspective, but also from a brand perspective and how relatable it was to the mainstream. It was always a bit of a kind of little niche with its legacy kind of purchasers. And so we wanted to come in and kind of shake things up. And we had a chance to do that. After launching, we grew really quickly. We became the UK's fastest growing company in food or drink for a couple of years. And we went from sort of zero to now around 20 million annual sales in 5 years. So it's been a really exciting growth story. We're also chasing down getting to profitability as well, because that's been our missing piece, because we prioritized growth for a few years, but now we're really prioritizing profit to make us a sustainable business. And so we have achieved what we've achieved, I think, through really, really committed product development and R&D. We've really gone the extra mile, I think. And also through an engaging brand, which has been kind of hard to ignore at times. We've done a lot of PR stunts and we've kind of shaken things up and ruffled feathers. And I think it's kind of put us on the map. So that's kind of where we are. And I stepped down about 4 months ago because I wanted to pursue other things. And the job description changed a lot from being an early stage founder to being a later stage CEO. And now I founded a nonprofit called A Bit Weird, which is focused on making needless animal suffering a bit weird. And so it's animal welfare based. And that's what I'm doing now.
Okay. So I suppose this is quite a well-known brand in the UK now. It's probably, yes, like you said, it's a top growing company, or the top growing company. And is that across all food sectors? Or is that just in the kind of sort of plant-based sector?
So in 2022, I believe we were the fastest growing company in food or drink across all sectors in food or drink. I think now we're probably the fastest growing in plant-based, because we sort of slowed down. I mean, it's kind of inevitable to some degree when you get bigger. Sort of, there are younger upstarts with higher growth figures, but in other sectors, but we're definitely showing the most growth in plant based, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah, I expect you've had quite a lot of negative feedback over the growth of this in regard to your products. You know, it's quite a contentious area to try and break into, isn't it? So, I mean, has this been difficult to deal with, and how have you kind of dealt with some negative feedback about your products?
I wouldn't say the experience has been characterized by much negative feedback. I mean, you always get some, whether it's product related or business related or whatever. But Yeah, I think the key is to take on board any negative feedback, which is valid as you see it, and ignore the kind of hate for hate's sake. I think the reason why it's contentious is because people are sometimes a bit fearful that their current lifestyle and convenience and meat consumption is kind of like under threat by these new companies like ours, which to some degree maybe it is slightly, but yeah, I think it's just a kind of fear of change and a fear that people are being sanctimonious and telling you what to do with your life, and actually you should have the liberty to choose whatever you want to eat. And I think that's what leads to people sometimes being a bit negative or hateful.
Yeah, and I suppose that's sort of what's linked with to your new project because, I mean, looking at different ways of reaching people, I suppose reaching the public now that because there's a lot of the methods I suppose are kind of looking at the misery suffered by animals and kind of trying to make people feel bad about animal suffering. So your approach is brand new. Can you tell us a little bit about that then?
Yeah, so I have a theory that animal advocacy has not been very effective. And actually, I think in the UK and much of the world, animals have a worse time now than they've ever had in terms of severity of suffering and the breadth of suffering, and actually the overall kind of numbers of animals that are suffering. We've reached a point in animal agriculture where, very high efficiency has been sought out, and there's a direct correlation between efficiency and basically suffering and like poor conditions, because you can't be a really efficient animal farm and have like loads of land per animal and have like animals living to a ripe old age, and things get worse and worse and worse and worse as you get more efficient. And so for that reason, I think that to date animal advocacy has largely been a failed movement. And so I've tried to unpack why, and my personal view on why is that the type of messaging just bounces off your average mainstream person. I think it's always quite grave, serious, and angry, and people might see it as sanctimonious and, holier than thou. And I think they switch off and it becomes white noise. And it's almost a bit of a kind of annoyed eye roll when they hear something about animal rights or veganism. So I've tried to cook up a new sort of playbook for how to do it, and it may or may not work. I'm perfectly open to the idea that it will fail, but hopefully it will be effective. And I basically want to use fun and humor and silliness to talk about suffering and death. And I think that's something which, at the very least, has not really been tried before, especially in the animal rights kind of world. So yeah, I want to use kind of PR stunts and fun, and I want to engage people. I want to have an a bit weird podcast where we get really weird guests on and talk about how weird they are or not. And so those kind of things. And so yeah, that's kind of how A Bit Weird was born, essentially.
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting idea, and I suppose kind of using fun to try and sell products that could otherwise cause some concern or some contention. It perhaps isn't a new thing. I mean, there was I know for example, they found, didn't they, some companies that when they wrote on their pizza boxes that the pizzas were extra healthy, they were kind of 20% less fat, and that the boxes were good for the environment and that sort of thing, that their sales dropped because people don't necessarily like being lectured to. And is this something that you have also applied in this? I mean, are you kind of using this kind of marketing to, is this part of your marketing technique with this?
100%. I mean, A Bit Weird is a very, very direct descendant of this in some ways, because, at this, we never talked about environmental credentials of the products on packaging or on marketing material. We never talked about the ethical issues and the upsides, therefore, of having this. It was always kind of winning hearts and minds through having fun and being stupid. And, we happen to sell these great products that are tasty. So we'd actually completely ignore all of the things that the previous brands in the space, the existing brands, used to talk about quite a lot. And for us, it worked. So the style of advocacy and the way I want to communicate is actually a direct, product of my experience at this.
So why do you think this has been such a successful brand? Is it the product, is it the marketing, or is it sort of combination of something else?
I honestly think it's 50-50, the product quality through relentless R&D, and I think the brand, how it's disrupted and got noticed and been a bit more engaging. So I think it's 50-50 when I think about why we've managed to make some progress in the space. Oh, probably a third thing actually. We were quite effective at raising capital, and that allowed us to make more of a dent. So I think that's probably a third thing. So maybe it's kind of 40-40-20.
So what is it about? I mean, is it just the quality of your product, or is it something that has been a convincing alternative to meat because people eat it and think, well, it's a good replacement, or is it something else?
Yeah, so when it comes to the product quality, it's exactly that. I think on a very, very basic level, it's people try it and they say, this is yummy, and this is a really, really like close match to what I'm used to. And on a more complicated level, it's because we have just tried so hard and put so much resource into R&D. We have an enormous R&D function for the size of business we are. So I think we have, like, I don't know, 17 people in R&D, and our entire team is only like 47 people. So nearly half the business is just like scientists. So we really, really, really have taken it extremely seriously. And examples I could give you, like, our chicken pieces, we've measured them in terms of how fibrous they are. So how many, those fibers when you eat chicken, you get those kind of stringy bits. Ours have more fibers per sort of cubic centimeter than the other plant-based chickens on the market. We create succulents where it needs to be there through like really clever fat systems, where the fat is like encapsulated and it doesn't leak away when you cook it, because sometimes plant-based products have fat in them, but then you cook them and then the fat just like goes away in the pan. We've managed to emulsify, just which is quite simple, like, but it hasn't been done before really. So we've emulsified fats so that they stay intact until you eat them, and then you bite into them, and then you get this kind of nice succulence coming through. Our sausages have got, to replace that skin you get on meat sausages, we've used algae essentially. So like sodium alginate, so it's like algae, and it basically is a crispy skin, just like the kind of skin that you get when you cook a sausage. So all of these small details amount to quite a big shift in quality versus what has been kind of what's gone before.
So do you use I spoke to Believer Meats. They use 3D printing to get the sort of layers and the textures and that sort of chewy kind of texture in their food. Is this a technique you use?
So we don't use 3D printing. To my knowledge, there's no like very, very scaled up, highly commercial 3D printing operation that we would have access to. I think it's getting there, but I think it's still like a little bit niche. I also have tried 3D products, and my preference was always, who knows about the future, but in the past, my preference was always not go for that style. If I found it difficult to get something, to find something which had been 3D printed and seemed like very random and organic in its kind of form. Because 3D printing is very good at uniform stuff and less good at like random. So yeah, it wasn't the technology of choice, but maybe, things have really progressed and I'm not aware of where it's at, but yeah.
I mean, you've been quite ambitious with your products. The product, this isn't bacon. I mean, it's what was your kind of development process behind this? I mean, this is quite a flagship product, wasn't it? I mean, it's quite a hard one to convince people on, isn't it? I mean, I know lots of vegetarians and vegans who say that the thing they miss most is bacon. So it's I can see why you did this, but
Well, we have an original bacon, which is the isn't bacon, and that product I was always slightly unhappy with it because it was the least convincing to meat of our products, and sort of still is. But it's a kind of cult favorite, and people love it, and it tastes good. We then released isn't streaky bacon essentially, so like, it's got kind of fat in it, and it's like really much much more realistic. And actually, that's kind of, people like it, but it's less successful than the original one that's less like bacon. And we actually had some initial teething problems with it. But basically, the reason we did isn't bacon at launch, we only had chicken and bacon at launch. So we had like three products, basically two chicken products and then the bacon. And the reason we did the bacon is because we thought that if we could have a compelling bacon with that smell that gets people downstairs when they're upstairs and they smell it, we could sort of win hearts and minds, because it's always been quite an elusive thing for plant-based food to create bacon. So we felt like if we could kind of crack it to some degree, we would become a, trusted name in the space, and I think we kind of did that, and it was a good move, because the bacon is still to this day one of our top selling products.
Yeah. So are you a scientist yourself? Is that have you got a science background? Are you
No, I don't. I've learned on the job. My co-founder Pete is he studied engineering at uni, so he's been always quite helpful with the R&D, and he can kind of speak the language as well when we're dealing with engineering.
Okay. So you started with chosen bun,
Yeah.
and then that developed into this. I mean, what was the transition like from Chosen Bun into a more kind of global sort of brand?
Yeah, so we sold Chosen Bun in 2016. It was a meat-based restaurant sort of takeaway business. And when we sold it, we were like, okay, next job, we've got to do something really constructive for the world, TBC on what it is. And then we decided to look at plant-based, because there were some companies in America that were doing interesting things versus anything else that was out there in the UK. So like Impossible Foods, Beyond Meat. So we flew to the States to try what they had created, and we were quite impressed. We came back and we thought, yeah, we could do some innovation in this sector. It's a bit sleepy and it's kind of not really changed much. So that's when we kind of built conviction that it was a good idea. And at the time, I wasn't actually vegan, and I wasn't sort of like, it was more just that I generally wanted to have a constructive type of career where sustainability is a good thing to be involved with. And then over time, I became more and more kind of bought in emotionally and ethically to the sort of cause, once I started learning more and more about animal farming, until eventually, became fully plant-based a few years ago, and then now here I am, kind of setting up a bit weird and spending a lot of my time and money on the cause. And so I've kind of done a bit of a U-turn from selling meat in a restaurant to now.
Yeah. So and also why did you choose a new CEO? Why did you and your co-founder step aside? What was the reason behind this?
So I touched on it earlier, but basically the job description changes massively from when you're an early stage founder at the beginning and you're executing a lot, you're doing a lot, you're creating stuff, you're just doing. And then later, when you've got a team of 50 odd, and the business is much bigger, you've got senior people who have been in their different roles for many years, your role becomes part kind of motivational speaker, part organizer in chief, where you're kind of just like aligning with people in meetings all day and just like making sure everyone's aligned and everyone's happy and bought in to the plan and following the plan. And it's just like such a different job. It's like the difference between a lawyer and a plumber. It's just like totally different.
Yeah.
And I was interested in and good at the first job, which is early stage founder and kind of bulldozing something into existence where there is nothing. I can do that. I'm not that good, and I'm not that interested really in being a professional CEO. And I had to go on that journey to really learn that, because my other startups had never gotten to the size where the job had changed so much. And now I know what I am and what I'm not. It's quite handy.
Yes.
So I could get management.
I suspect lots of startups go through that same process because clearly, I suppose especially startups in this space maybe, which are started up by sort of PhD scientists, And then they realize that they're not necessarily kind of business people or corporate people or
Yeah,
CEOs.
yeah.
So
Yeah, exactly.
I expect it's quite common.
I think so. And I'm left feeling completely kind of awestruck by the founders who set something up from scratch and then stay there when it gets to like £1 billion. I don't know how they do it. But I'm very impressed that they have that versatility.
So you say that you were looking at sort of impossible foods and companies like this. I mean, have you got any ambitions in the future to use cultivated meats or fats or ingredients in your plant-based foods?
So I think the answer is not really no or yes. The answer is that this is a technology agnostic company. So if cultivated meat becomes, much more viable commercially, and we think there's an opportunity to use it in our products, then yeah, for sure. We've got no principles against using new technologies of any sort, as long as they're not animal based and they don't cause suffering. I think this will be interested. So whilst we don't have an agenda at the moment to look at cultivated meat, because it's still just a bit early on in its journey. Precision fermentation is another really interesting area as well, where we're keeping an eye. But we don't have we don't have anything against any of these technologies, if you like. Oh no, we always just want to use plain plant-based R&D. No, it's not nothing like that. We're quite keen on exploring whatever works.
So you said that you were quite lucky with funding, because clearly funding has become a bit of an issue over the last couple of years. Do you think you were quite lucky in your timing? And what do you and do you think it's do you expect that the landscape might change in the near future in regard to funding?
Yeah, I'm not sure how lucky we were. I think that we were just effective at fundraising. I mean, lucky to some extent because I had a privileged upbringing and I can speak well and be compelling, which is kind of something that, helps when you're fundraising. So that's lucky. But in terms of, fundraising, we didn't get any leg ups or parents giving us money. It was like we did the job and went and fundraised. So we were effective. I think the timing was good, but that was by design. We looked at the sector and we thought, this is good timing, let's get in. So I hope that's not a defensive answer, by the way. I'm not sure how much luck there was in that sense.
I suppose I mean lucky just because the last 2 or 3 years, the whole kind of funding landscape has dropped off. It might have been harder to start a company like that now than it was then.
I think that's really fair. But we knew it was a good time, and that's part of the draw. So it was kind of a conscious choice of ours to get in at that good time. Well, we didn't know it would drop off quite how it has, but our company has shown really strong growth throughout the journey so far. So we've managed to fundraise up until recently. We did a funding round like summer last year, quite recently. So it has been harder. Like the last funding round was definitely the hardest to complete. But yeah, it's a shame. But the fact is that plant-based as a whole has not quite delivered in the same way that it was expected of it by all the investors in 2018, 19.
Yeah. So what advice might you give to people who are struggling to raise funds in this climate from your own experience?
I think the first thing is like have a very, very clear and demonstrable plan to profitability, because that's what investors are most kind of nervous about. Companies that will just burn their cash forever and ever and ever. So like, yeah, having a really clear plan to profitability is very important. I think the second thing is like, I think if you don't have products which are kind of game changing and hard to ignore, then I wouldn't bother fundraising because you won't get anywhere probably. If you just, because a lot of me too products have come in plant-based over the years. And so, it's important for founders to not do that anymore because the investors aren't falling for it. So I think those are probably the two kind of nuggets I would offer. But regardless of what advice people receive, it is always going to be really tough to fundraise in plant-based at the moment.
Yeah. So what was I mean, were you are your investors, are they sort of venture capitalists, angel investors, or more sort of equity investors? What's is your Is
Pretty
your
much all of the above. I mean, we've raised like 50 million pounds for the business so far. So the investor base is quite varied. We've got lots of venture capitalist investors. We've got growth stage investors who kind of came in the last round, like a sustainability focused growth fund called Planet First. And we've got a bit of debt through v venture finance. Venture debt. So we got kind of all kinds of funding.
Okay.
And that's quite normal because, you know, when you're doing 300 grand of revenue, you need a very different type of investor to when you're doing 20 million. So it's in that sense not that unusual that we've got lots of different investors.
Yeah. So the debt is this. I know there's the European Investment Bank. They are, they have a lot of money to hand out for these kind of environmentally forward-thinking companies. Was this one of the banks that you went to?
No, we didn't. It's difficult to go to a bank really when you're loss making. So venture debt is where you tend to gravitate towards. So there are venture debt funds which basically charge more for the debt and the lending is a bit more risky. So that's where we've got debt from in the past. I think we've paid most of it off now, but we took a few million at the time.
Okay. So how soon do you think? I mean, you said earlier that you expect to be in profit within the next year or two. Is that right?
Yeah, I think the end of this year slash beginning of next year we'll start to get quite close. I think that'll be when we reach break even, hopefully.
Okay. So that's an exciting time for you. That's kind of a turnaround event, I suppose.
Hugely exciting. We're really, really hopeful. I mean, it depends on a lot, right? It depends on performance. If sales were to slump, then it would be much, much harder to get there. If sales were to spike, then it would be easier to get there. So it's a little bit like tricky to pin a date, but that's what we're aiming for.
Yeah. So back to a bit weird. Where do you see that? What's the ambition for that project?
I am really, really, really ambitious with a bit weird. I'd say I'm more ambitious with a bit weird than I've been with any business in the past. I want to make the most impact possible. I want a bit weird to be at the forefront of an enormous change with regards to how we treat animals, how we see as humans our place in respect to animals, and what we can and can't do to them. Like I'm so excited to try and like make an impact in that space. So yeah, ambition is absolutely huge for sure.
So it's a form of activism, would you say? This it's kind of changing the look of sort of animal activism.
I hope so. Yeah, animal advocacy, activism, animal welfare, animal rights. I think there's a lot of stuff that has slipped into being quite normal over many, many years. It's been a kind of creep over generations with humans. And I think actually some of that stuff should not be normal, and actually it's a bit weird. So you know, things like chick culling, things like how we castrate lambs, things like, you know, frankly, dairy. I mean, interspecies milking is completely bonkers.
Yeah.
If you were walking through the Serengeti and you saw a lion suckling the teat of an elephant for milk, you would just be, you know, the elephant's babies were just there watching. You think, what the hell is going on? But that's what we do with cows. We impregnate them and we remove the babies so that they don't take the milk, and then we take the breast milk for ourselves. It's completely nuts.
Yeah.
But we've normalized it, and so I want to try and just have a bit of a review with a bit weird, and just be like, well, perhaps we should just look at this and just check. It should definitely be normal.
Yes.
That's kind of what I'm trying to do.
Normal and natural. I mean, there's always a big argument against cultivated meat and things like that because a lot of people deem it as unnatural. But of course, if they went and sort of spent a day in an abattoir, they might perhaps kind of readjust what they think is natural and good.
Yeah. I think so. I mean, if you know, how natural is it for a human to have cow's breast milk? You know, not supernatural. How natural are all the chickens that we eat, which are broilers, and they've been precision bred over 50 plus years to be 8 times the size of the nature's chicken? You know, none of it's natural. It's you sometimes get these. I was on a panel last night with people from the sort of animal agriculture industry, and you get a lot of people who really don't want to let go. And so they basically champion these very edge case, like niche, you know, oh, it's very regenerative and it's beautiful what we do at this estate and you should all come see it. And actually it's like you always get this nonsense. And it's basically just like, you know, it's just coal power stations done slightly better. And it's like, just let it go, man. It's just like nonsense. You can't feed 50, 70 million people in the UK through doing your like nonsense regenerative, like 15 acres per cow nonsense. So it's just like, yeah,
Yes.
it's just, sorry, I've been on a bit of a rant there.
No, that's good. No, I mean, I suppose this is what Future of Foods is all about. And I've just written a piece that's kind of talking about exactly this, because I grew up on a dairy farm. So I used, you know, as a child, I'd kind of walk along and wonder why the cows weren't, you know, weren't rebelling and rising up and kind of taking over the country. So yes, I have grown up sort of thinking it's all a bit weird, which is why I was sort of drawn to your campaign. And also because I've you know, I see what Peter does, Petter, and I kind of turn away whenever they kind of show any of their videos. And obviously they don't really want people to turn away because they're not really going to influence people, and it makes people sort of angry. So it's I think the idea of just sort of what you're doing, I think it makes kind of sense. It's sort of, yes, it's kind of touching people's sense of what is right, what is weird, what is natural, or you know, but in a more balanced way, perhaps.
I think so, and I hope so. That's the goal. And we're just getting started. I'm a couple of weeks in, really.
Yeah.
So I'm excited to see what we can do, but it's very, very humble beginnings at the moment.
And do you hope to sort of start a bit of as a media campaign on this then that will be far-reaching? Is that part of it?
Yeah, I hope to do many media campaigns over the years. So the first thing I'm working on should surface around April time. Basically, yeah, working on a kind of legal based project, which I can't really talk about because I sort of undermine it. But basically, that should hopefully get some press coverage. Fingers crossed. And then I'll also start lobbying more on the chick culling soon as well. So yeah, I plan to leverage PR. I mean, I think PR is really the very best marketing channel for any charity because it's free. So if you can get it right and you can get noticed, I think it's good.
No, obviously there's a lot of noise coming from the meat lobbying companies in regard to media output. Do you think there needs to be a more kind of consolidated effort by the plant-based cultivated meat precision fermented industries to try and push back on that?
I do, and I think that view is definitely shared by so many other people in the space. And you've got people who are trying, like the Plant-Based Food Alliance, is it called or something? And then you've got a couple of other ones. So I think people are trying, but the fact is that the vegan and plant-based kind of movements are so fragmented, and meat has done a much better job of being consolidated. I mean, it's had a few hundred years longer, but still. It is something, you're absolutely right, something we need to work really hard on because we're just nowhere near. And so that would be an amazing thing in the future. I mean, a bit weird is a bit small and a bit early to worry about it, but it'd be amazing for a bit weird to play a role in that in the future when we're hopefully a bit more established.
Yes. I mean, it's funny you mentioned the vegetarians and vegans, because quite often they can be quite you know, quite sort of separatist in their own way. I mean, I've, you know, because I had a podcast on kind of in ovo sexing for chicks, and I was surprised by how many kind of negative responses I got from vegans who were perhaps a little binary in their approach, sort of saying, you know, that no one should be eating eggs, and fine, but I mean, people do, and this makes it better. So
Yeah.
it's kind of levels, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And I'm of course of the view that people shouldn't be eating factory farmed eggs. But I'm working on chick culling for the same reason that you described. Whilst it's here, I want to make, and also it's not just that actually, because I want to make it better. But at the same time, I think if you start to bring these issues up and people start learning about chick culling, they might then go on a journey of discovery about other things which they think are bad, because they were like, oh, I didn't know there was anything wrong with eggs. It's actually how I ended up being plant based is. I found out about chick culling like 6, 7 years ago or something. And I was like, oh, I thought eggs were like the fine one. And I thought there was nothing wrong with eggs. And then I started looking at other things and beak trimming. And then I started looking at dairy and like calf snatching and, all of this different stuff then stemmed from that one discovery. So I almost think if you tell people about these things, then they'll start to go down a little bit of a journey sometimes.
Yeah, and of course, in the UK, there isn't any in ovo sexing yet, is there? So, I mean, hopefully, talking about it might encourage farmers in this country to use that, in the near future.
Well, it's what a bit weird is really focused on. That's one of our three key goals is to try and see an end to chick culling in the UK.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Andy. This has been a great conversation. Thank you for being
Thanks for having
available.
me.
Yep, and I will be following with great interest your work.
Thanks, Alex. Really good to chat.
Yes, thank you for coming on Future of Foods interviews.